Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. Today I talk to Sly Castaldi and Jessica St. Peter, the executive director and public educator, respectively, of Guelph Wellington Women in Crisis. They deal with issues of violence against women all year round, but for at least one day of the year, one date on the calendar makes us all stop and think about femicide and gender-based violence because that's the anniversary of the worst mass shooting in Canadian history, and it was all directed at women, as the perpetrator himself was heard to say that he was, quote, fighting feminism before he opened fire. Now, December 6th is the National Day of Remembrance and Action on Violence Against Women, and while we've done a lot to remember, how are we doing on the action part? That is the topic of this week's Guelph Politicast. First, let us remember the names. Genevieve Bergeron, Helene Colgan, Natalie Croteau, Barbara Degano, Anne-Marie Edward, Maud Havernick, Maurice Leganier, Maurice Leclerc, Anne-Marie LeMay, Sonia Pelletier, Michelle Richard, Annie St. Arnaud, Annie Turcotte, and Barbara Klujnik-Vidayevich. Nearly all of them were engineering students, and they were all targeted because they were women working or studying at L'École Polytechnique in Montreal. Though people have spent years trying to drill down to the exact circumstances that led to Marc Le Pen killing 14 women and injuring 10 others before turning the gun on himself, the fact of the matter is that his crime was thoroughly women-hating. He walked into a classroom, separated the men from the women, and then shot the women. There's absolutely no doubt that what's been called the Montreal Massacre was an instance of gender-based violence, and while its scale has not been duplicated, violence against women is still omnipresent in Canada and around the world. And you might think of the Toronto van attack in 2018, which made international headlines, but the fact is that it's more of an everyday occurrence than you would like to think. According to the Canadian Femicide Observatory for Justice and Accountability at the University of Guelph earlier this year in a report, they said a woman or a girl is killed every 2.5 days in Canada, and these are not deaths by strangers. Nearly half, 47.7%, are killed by a spouse or intimate partner, and another 30.5% are killed by a parent or other family member. Only 3.4% of murdered women and girls are killed in a crime, as compared to 16.2% of men. Only 4% of men are killed by a spouse or intimate partner. Those numbers paint quite a picture, don't they? So, how much progress have we really made in tackling gender-based violence here in Canada in the last 30 years? That's one of the many questions I posed to Sly Castaldi and Jessica St. Peter, and this edition of the podcast covers a lot of ground. We talk about what they think about every 6th of December, how the discourse around gender-based violence has changed over the last 3 decades, and the recent social movements like Me Too and the Unfounded series by Globe and Mail investigative reporter Robin Doolittle. We also talk about the role of education in eliminating gender-based violence and the role that men need to play reaching that goal, including a segment where I am the one answering the questions. This is a very expansive discussion, but one that continues to be so very important 30 years after the fact. So I caught up with Sly Castaldi and Jessica St. Peter on Monday at the offices of Women in Crisis here in Guelph.
My name is Sly Castaldi. I'm the executive director of Guelph Wellington Women in Crisis.
And I'm Jessica St. Peter, and I'm a public educator with Guelph Wellington Women in Crisis.
And thank you both of you for joining me today, although, I mean, given the subject matter and where we sit right now, that doesn't sound quite right.
But subject matter when you're in this field is never really positive.
I can't imagine. But maybe to start with, 30 years ago, mm-hmm. December 6th, mm-hmm. what do you guys think about when this time of year comes around? What's top of mind?
I think for me, like, I remember I was 26 years old when December 6th happened, and I woke up that morning to the news. I think it was Seajoy at that time, not Magic, but, and I heard the report, and I was getting ready to go to work, and it's hard to make sense of that. And you got to remember, 30 years ago, there was no internet, right? There was no, round-the-clock news, so whatever information that was coming through was either coming through on the radio or I was waiting to get home that night to watch it on the news.
Right.
And so it was very different the way the information was unfolding 30 years ago than it would be today. And it was jarring, that news that came, because, you know, prior to that there wasn't very many things that captured the nation's attention. And I remember, because I was working here part-time on the weekends at the shelter, and so I remember the agency scrambling to put together a vigil for that night, some sort of memorial for people to come together to, I don't know, talk about what had happened, try to make sense of what had happened. But and it was interesting because after the initial shock, you had people who were trying to dismiss this as a lone act, an individual act of an individual person who was suffering from obviously some mental health issues, to those who were saying, this is what femicide looks like, this is what misogyny looks like when it's carried to the extreme end. And so the battle of those two philosophies were coming to a head in articles that followed immediately after, and in news reports where people were talking about trying to make sense of what happened. But in terms of how that day impacted us, I think it became the day that galvanized the nation to say, we can no longer look at this issue as an individual thing.
Right.
This is what violence against women looks like. This is what misogyny looks like. And the fact that he had separated the men from the women, you know, became painfully obvious that it was misogyny.
Right.
How old were you, Jess?
I was four.
You were four.
I was four. I remember my first December 6th vigil when I was on a post-secondary campus, like that feeling of what actually happened when you read the news coverage, and but to remember that actual moment, I don't. But just the tension it creates in classrooms, and even like in the hallways, what it means when you are in a program that's predominantly men, or versus a program that's predominantly female, or when you look at even applications, and we hear it now still. When, you know, I'll have men make comments about entry into different programs that are typically male-dominated programs, still having that idea, oh, well, women are going to get in because they're taking away spots from men, and connecting that back to the coverage of that event in 1989 and seeing how there's still that stigma around what should be a field for women and what shouldn't be, and to attend the vigils on campus here at the U of G and hear male staff talk about the changes that have happened and what it means to have women in those fields, and the progress that's being made, and scholarships and things like that are so important.
It strikes me that, you know, listening to you guys talk, especially you, Sly, who have you know, lived it, there was no blueprint for this.
No.
That, you know, you talked about having to scramble. That's because, you know, having to respond to a mass shooting, just even in a general way.
Yeah.
That was so odd. That was so unprecedented.
Yeah, yeah. There was no, I think for the violence against women sector and those people who were working in shelters or crisis centers, this was probably our worst nightmare, right? And so it's not like we knew how to do vigils or plan for this kind of stuff or even hold conversations, because you got to remember that was post Me Too, that was post Believe Survivors, that was post pre. Those were hard things to try and figure out, because up until that time we were still trying to get people to understand and build an awareness around violence against women being wrong, that we all had to take responsibility, not only as communities, as individuals, communities, as a province, as a country, right? And so I think for us it had a profound impact on our psyche. Mm. You know.
And when it became a national day of recognition, mm, yeah, right? It wasn't just something that happened in Montreal, but that the country took it as a day that we were going to continue to recognize because of the severe impact that it had and the message that it sent to all women really entering, mm-hmm, those spaces of, you know, that fear of, well, what could happen, or who doesn't think I deserve to be here, or what could possibly go wrong. But to see, even when we talk about femicide list and we talk about keeping statistics after 1989, it was that moment that made it a day that, okay, people actually see what we've been talking about, mm-hmm, and see the worst case scenario of misogyny and violence against women and how it will play out in the lives of everyone, even if it's not a personal relationship, right? Where,
right,
there is that talk about, oh, well, violence against women is a personal issue, or it happens behind closed doors, and these are public spaces where this happened and the impact. You know, people left their homes not knowing what was going to happen that day, mm-hmm, besides, mm-hmm, choosing, I'm going to continue my education, I'm going to, you know, take the next step in my journey, and then this is what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Sly mentioned me too, and I think that there's an element of that that makes me, and I've, you know, seen a lot of the discussions that come out of that, but what these things sort of do is put it in the front of mind of everyone that, mm-hmm, these are things that women think about every day.
Mm-hmm.
That, not necessarily the Mark Le Pens of, mm-hmm, the world, but people who have similar thoughts, not necessarily taking it to the extreme, but, you know, what you were talking about, Jessica, but the thoughts like, you don't belong here because you're a woman, this is a man's field, and that kind of thing, that you have to almost have a third eye, it feels like, being a woman, right, sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I you know what's interesting about that? I think that after 1989... when the subsequent years that followed in terms of whether we did the Take Back the Night March or the December 6th vigil, it's interesting that you say that, Adam, because there were a couple of years right after the massacre that when we were holding our marches or the vigils, people were conscious of the fact that here's a gathering space of feminists and people who are concerned about femicide.
Mm-hmm.
And it was always in the back of my mind around, like, it could happen again.
Yeah.
It could happen again at this gathering. And I remember a friend of mine said to me, especially, I think it was one of the Take Back the Night marches in the early 90s, that said, are you sure it's safe to have these marches anymore? Because what's stopping somebody from attacking the crowd or whatever? And so it became even more real,
yeah,
you know, that we are vulnerable. Not only were you vulnerable in all sorts of ways that violence against women impacts your life every day, but now it became even more public in terms of the spaces where you might feel safe, right? And so, and I remember those conversations, and I thought, oh my God, this is bizarre, like, that somebody, yeah, would even think that. And then when it gets into your head, that you start thinking that. And I remember the year that they did the national march on in Ottawa, and they had the caravan that was traveling across the country,
mm-hmm,
and they made a stop in Guelph, right? And that, I think it was the Friday, so the van, I think, showed up on either Saturday or Sunday. I can't remember the date. But on that Friday afternoon, we got a death threat on our voicemail. Mm. So I had to call the organizers of the caravan to say, we've received a death threat. And we had to call the police, and the police were at the march, the gathering of the march, in plain clothes.
Mm-hmm.
Keeping an eye on the crowd and everything. And I remember that, and I'm thinking, like, you know, and that was several years after the December 6th,
right,
massacre. So it's not that it's always out of our minds, you know, like, it's always somewhere there that you're cognizant of how vulnerable you are.
Mm-hmm.
I think Guelph was the only one who got a death threat, too.
For the caravan.
Yeah, for the Women's March. So it was, yeah, it was quite, quite bizarre. And you know, I was talking to the organizers, and they were trying to make a decision whether they were going to still come or not, but they decided that, no, you can't, we can't stop doing the work that we have to do because people are making threats.
It strikes me as so bizarre, right? And you know, I'm not saying I'm, you know, an innocent lamb or 100% woke, but, you know, I struggle with this. So I can't imagine how you guys working in this, you know, in the women in crisis feel on a daily basis. You're able to answer the phone and you get a death threat because you're promoting safety.
Equality and safety.
Equality, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And not just, you know, for women, but for everyone. And that's the thing, right, is that it becomes an us or them, and it isn't about that, right? Ending violence isn't about impacting violence on men. It's about ending violence and realizing that it'll benefit everyone.
How much has the picture changed, do you feel? And, you know, this, again, might be directed more to you, Salai, having been there, shall we say, but, you know, Jessica, you can probably speak to the last couple of years, especially with Me Too, where there's, you know, sort of great awareness. I'm also thinking of Robin Doolittle's Unfounded series that we're very slowly kind of peeling back the layers and realizing just how deep the rot goes. That was a better metaphor than I thought going into it. But, but, you know, are we getting better or are we just more aware of the rot?
Well, I think that that's a very complex kind of question in terms of I'd like to think that for sure for the last 30 years we have made some gains, that there's certainly more awareness than there ever has been. I think now in terms of you'd be hard pressed to find somebody that says, well, you know, if a woman's being abused, that, you know,
she had it coming.
She had it coming kind of stuff. So you don't hear that kind of discourse anymore. I think the discourse around sexual violence is still very complicated. I think there's still a lot of blame and shame. We haven't quite got over that hurdle. And but I think that Me Too and Time's Up has done a lot for upping the conversation. But still, I think that, take your point around Robin Doolittle's Unfounded, that's all been going on in the last little while. And so it's not like that series came out 10 years ago. That series was the last few years that she did it. And so figuring out that the way sexual violence is being investigated and treated was, again, another thing that said, okay, like, this is the thing, Adam. The evidence is always there, and we still discredit it. You know, we still find ways to say, oh, my God, that's shocking. Oh, my God, that shouldn't be like that. But it still is. I think while awareness is probably at an all-time high, what that does for us and those working in the violence against women field is that it just brings more survivors to the door.
Right.
Right? And so, yeah, there's lots of people who are wanting to access services, but I can tell you that across this province, the shelters are full, right? In this day and age, the shelters are full. So women can't get into a shelter and they can't get out of a shelter because there's no affordable housing. I can tell you that in terms of rape crisis centers, that the waiting list for getting counseling around sexual violence are getting longer and longer. So that's great that more people are wanting to access service and talk about their experiences and reach out. But the problem is that we're at capacity.
Yeah.
Right? And so people are having to wait for service, which to me is the part that we're struggling with right now. So, yeah, some things are... we're not having to fight as hard to say, see, this is real, right? The issues are very present today. Believe survivors. That part isn't so much a struggle. Still a struggle.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
Not everybody believes every survivor, but I think that it's better than it was, and the last 30 years have worked towards building the capacity for the violence against women sector to respond. Funding has increased, not to the point that we need it, right. But it's gotten better. Our awareness has gotten better. Again, not to the place where we want it, but better than it was. There is better response from the criminal justice system, not where it needs to be,
yeah. But
slightly better. So I think while our responses have improved, they're not at a place that they should be for as we go into a new decade of 2020.
Yeah.
And I think about just getting ready for the December 6th vigil and going through all the names on the femicide list and how it's one day, right? We recognize nationally one day to end violence against women, and because 14 women died on that day. But here we are looking just in 1 year, mm-hmm. in the last year, we're at, 37 women and children mm-hmm. that have died as a result. And we don't highlight that issue when it happens, right? We're not, when those cases happen in the media and things like that, people see them as separate.
Right.
Or not part of an attack against women or about inequality or about power and control in abusive and violent relationships, but that we don't talk about it as an issue like that until this one day a year,
right.
Where we then look at, we collect all this information and then we have this list of women who have been killed by people who told them they loved them, by people they trusted, by people, you know, that they thought, you know, cared, and without looking at the struggle of inequality and looking at how women are viewed, seeing that change. But now I would say there's more awareness around what are those red flags, and people emphasis on trusting women's interpretations of their relationships, right? Like, they're afraid, and that means something, instead of, it's nothing, or it's not as bad as you think it is.
Right.
But that we have these unfortunate worst case scenarios where a woman has been killed, and we then review what are the situations that led up to that so that we can be more aware and catch it in the future.
That seems almost like a fault of media in a way, because something like what happened on December 6th, 1989, that gets a lot of attention because of the sheer numbers.
Mm-hmm.
But if one woman is killed by her partner, that's a crime, obviously, but it's also one of a number of crimes that the news deals with in mm-hmm. a day. And it's not necessarily given that context beyond, I will hear news reports like, this is the sixth homicide in Peel region this mm-hmm. year or something like that. But aside from that, maybe it would help if people in the media start contextualizing that, like, this is the 36th woman to be killed by her partner in Canada in a year.
Yeah.
And it depends, like, what kind of angle the media is able to get, right? If family knew, like, those stories mm-hmm. where you hear family talk about how afraid the woman was or what was leading up to it, or, you know, there's an endless document of police calls before for domestic violence and things like that, then that gets put into context. But for some reason, we always talk about, just like the women's voices have been silenced and they've been stripped down and disempowered, we then see it again in the way they're reported. And it just becomes, they are killed, but then we place so much emphasis on what mental health issues was this person dealing with, you know, what they lost their job this day. So as if it's some kind of justification instead of looking at the issue of what's greater, like what's going on that's greater.
I wonder if we can do both, though. Because, I mean, there are instances, of course, of people being long-time abusers and then eventually killing their partner.
Right.
But people do also snap.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I guess, you know, what's the balance of that? You know, how do we cover all the angles? That's a big question. Mm-hmm. It's tricky.
And I'm not sure I would agree that people snap.
Yeah.
You know, I think that it's been well documented in research that when a woman leaves an abusive relationship, that's when she's most at risk.
Right.
When he loses control.
Mm.
And I think it's more an act of the final control, as opposed to I snapped. I got overwhelmed. You know, because for the long time, the media was always reporting crimes of passion or this or that.
No, right.
It's crime of possession.
Right.
And that's even when you say lose control, people think like, oh, they lost control of their mind. Yeah, no, they lost control over
of the person. And I think the more we're able to educate, the more then we may start to switch the attitudes and the myths that keep getting reinforced through the media. And now, with the OPP making a decision not to release the gender of the victim or perpetrator, now I think the violence against women is going to be even harder to sort of acknowledge and say, okay, yeah, this is the 10th femicide, this is the 10th thing in this community or whatever. And so it's like the thing is, Adam, whenever we make progress in terms of pushing the issues forward, the backlash comes at us and it feels like we're always going a little bit backwards to get a few steps ahead. This is a very real issue and it happens in every community. And now we've added the whole element of human trafficking, which is really hard for people to wrap their heads around.
Yeah.
And so violence against women continues. In this country, we know that the stats on women who experience sexual violence, women who experience domestic violence, women who are killed every 2 days in this country, like, that should be alarming. So if that was a medical issue, right, if women were dying because of a disease, we would have a lot of resources and a plan of attack on how to deal with this epidemic.
If 14 people were killed at the same salad bar, we'd never eat salad again.
Exactly, right? Like, I mean, but we don't treat it the same way. When it comes to violence against women, you know, we talk about resources because we're lumped into all of this social services stuff, but it is an epidemic.
And it strikes me that thing with the OPP.
Mm-hmm.
That some people would look at that and like, oh, that's them being woke because we're all equal, right? It just shouldn't matter if we're men or women. Mm-hmm. This person was killed. And there's something very false about that.
Yeah, because I think that gender identity, hate crimes are a real specific thing that the public should be made aware of and put into some context. But if you're saying individual A was killed by individual B, how do you make sense of that? How does that contribute to the discourse? How does that contribute to dealing with particular issues?
It's very antiseptic.
Well, exactly. Yeah.
I do want to touch on education a bit, because I did, when I was preparing for this, there was a report recently that using the right words, that battling gender-based violence starts with using the right words. And Google, not Google, Global, I don't know if they're trying to be cute, but you know, the headline was "Vagina, not hoo-ha. Ending gender-based violence starts with the right words."
That was Farrakhan.
I didn't read the article. I saw it though. I saw the headline.
I read the article, but the headline is what struck me, and that, you know, the details of the article too. That, you know, kids playing doctor and, you know, PP and this kind of thing. We treat that, you know, our bodies in this, or at least certain parts of our bodies, in a very, you know, juvenile way until, you know, we're 12, 13, and then it becomes starkly serious. And I remember, too, the struggle over the sex ed.
Mm-hmm.
And people were so mad about, you know, saying to a six-year-old, it's a vagina and a penis, it's not, you know.
But there was a lot, you know what I would say about the sex ed curriculum, though? There was a lot of misinformation about it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah,
like, I don't think a lot of people actually knew what was in it. They just heard the rumors, they heard the fear-mongering around the sex ed curriculum, and then all of a sudden it starts to become fact. which it really wasn't, right? And our position has always been, you need, like, education, information is power. And the only way to help people is to give them the information so that they know what is going on, you know, as opposed to sort of say, no, let's keep everybody in the dark. Let's not give our kids the best chance possible to understand these issues, to learn these issues, so that they can best deal with them when they are complicated, when they are confronted with complicated issues.
Right, and it strikes me too, and maybe your role here is education, but, you know, we mystify this part of ourselves, the quote-unquote private parts, you know, our sexuality until you get to a certain age, you know, 11, 12, 13, and then we info dump on young kids
right. All
this information about, you know, the birds and the bees and you know, what being gender truly means.
And I think even saying things about using the proper language is more helpful for the parents who are uncomfortable talking about sex.
Oh, yeah, right? Absolutely.
It's about setting up an environment where your child knows their body, knows that it's safe to talk about their body, knows that their body isn't responsive to somebody else, that they can name it themselves, that they are aware of it, that it's not something to be ashamed of talking about, that they... you know, get to understand consent around who sees their body, when they see it, what, you know, all of those things. But the biggest advantage of that is that there are so many parents out there that are so uncomfortable with even saying the word vagina or penis or are afraid of what a child's wearing at the beach or what their child's not wearing at the beach, that being able to have those conversations is going to change that environment for that child growing up so much that if something was ever questioned or they had questions about even pleasure or feelings, that it wouldn't be this dirty, unforeseen thing, but that the parent is not going to be completely shocked, because kids respond to that. They know, oh, this isn't something we talk about in our house, or this is something that makes me dirty if I say these words, right? And then we see those kind of shame messages are also what perpetrators use to victimize young kids and women by playing on that idea that you can't tell anybody because you can't talk about this because it's dirty and naughty and that makes you bad.
Right, and if you have, you know, the one kid whose parents are a little more open about it and they're in their, you know, peer group and all the other kids are have parents maybe not as open, you know, they become the weirdo. And then that is in effect, you know, doing the work, undoing the work that, you know, those parents were a little more open to it because of the social stigma.
But it would be nice if kids learned it from their parents and learned those conversations instead of where it's most accessible right now, and that's online.
Yeah.
Right? So if your kid is going to hear a lot worse words than penis or vagina through their mainstream, whether any electronic device can get them access to things, right? So it's about creating that space and comfort level in your home and to have those conversations instead of it being waiting till it is reactionary, until it's responding to a violation or concern about inappropriate touching or unhealthy relationships, or especially so many of the young women, their pleasure isn't even something they think about. It's, you know, that sex doesn't have to be reactionary to what someone else wants, but that they can have desires and be comfortable to talk about them without being victim blamed or slut shamed or all these, you know, terrible stigma that goes with sexuality.
Mm-hmm. And it's not about erasing differences either.
No.
It's about respecting the differences and accepting that everybody is different.
Yeah, and being, and that respect that comes with it, right? Knowing, like Sly was saying, knowledge is power. And if something is so unknown to you or it's objectified, the only way you learn about it is through whether it's pornography or this voyeuristic approach, then of course kids are going to have these questions and things are going to happen in a way that isn't consensual, because it's not, hey, this is the difference in bodies or these are the things you're going to be experiencing. And who's going to do that? Because we can't leave it all for teachers to cover everything, right? When we think about teachers dealing with suicide, teachers dealing with eating disorders, teachers dealing with kids who don't come to school fed, now we want them to also, you know, prepare our kids for intimate relationships, relationships in general, or this idea that consent is only about sex when we can play out consent in every aspect of our life.
Yeah, and that was at the bookshelf conversation with Robin Doolittle, the idea that we can talk to usually university-aged people about the ideas of consent, and then it's all still very theoretical, that there's no practicum, I guess, of what consent looks like.
No, and you, if you think about where we're, where people are getting most of their socialization, it's either Disney as a child, right, that starts to form these kind of like unrealistic ideas about life, or pornography. Like, you know, you've got some pretty far apart realities, and
it's not even a spectrum. It's Disney then pornography.
Well, you know, it's like, I mean, all kids, you know, and I think that we have a responsibility around messaging that we have to stop and think about what the underlying messages are that we're feeding kids.
And stop being in such upheaval about the conversations, right?
Like, right.
People get so angry about what's going to be taught in sex ed curriculums, or what is this person going to talk about that's going to mess up my kids or give them questions that I don't have answers to. But then when something terrible happens, we have these parents who call and they're like, I don't know what to do. I want my kid to know that I am there for them, that I'll be there. And it's like, yes, I understand that, but you were just freaked out 6 months ago that someone was going to talk to them about their body. And and now we're in a place where you're grasping at some kind of assurance that you can do something right here.
Right. And, you know, it goes to the, how we treat the seriousness of the topic, too, that, you know, we have conversations all the time. We talk to people. We don't know where the conversation's going to go. And maybe this is just one of those, just to be open and willing to talk about things, knowing that you're not going to know where it goes, that maybe your kid will have a question that you don't have an answer to, and maybe that's okay. And maybe at that point you say, let's go get an answer together. And that's okay.
Yeah.
Do we just solve this?
I doubt it, Adam. but it's nice.
I wish.
Yeah.
I wish.
If it were that easy.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you.
But I see, like, what I would be interested in is how you see yourself just as a man in the world when it comes to these things, how you address it, right? Because we know when people come through our doors, how we respond or how you can support survivors. Or I think about my own interactions with friends and, you know, my job to hold men in my life accountable when they say things that are sexist or when they make comments that are oppressive to women. But what I want to know is, like, how do men feel in that environment? Like, what is it that stops somebody from taking a stand or feeling comfortable to address it?
I think, and, you know,
now we're interviewing.
I know.
You,
it's,
sorry,
it's not like something. No, I think one of the big things is the group, because I think when I've observed, you know, or even when I've been in other groups of men and the conversation, let's say, gets off color.
Right.
It's hard to take a stand in that predominantly male environment.
Why?
Because you don't want to be seen the odd person out, right?
Seen as why? Why?
Because
why do you want to not be the odd person out?
It has to do with social, like, not wanting to be, you know,
the raging feminist,
right.
The man-hating
right.
feminist.
Yeah. Exactly.
I have no problem with men, but I am seen to be a man-hater
for
some reason.
So why does supporting women and equal rights equate to then not seeing that? Like, why is that not a good thing for men to support?
I have no idea, honestly. And I think
that's the question.
That's the answer I want. That's really...
Because that's the question, right?
Yeah.
Because individually, everybody will say, oh, no, rape is wrong, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Violent, you know, woman abuse is wrong, blah, 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 you know, whatever. But when they're in a group.
Yeah.
And I call my buddy a pussy or say you're such a bitch.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's okay.
Why does that then, all of a sudden, like, it's that toxic masculinity that takes over.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, how is it that you can't sort of say, that's not okay? You don't have to be a goof about it or a jerk about it, but you can say, that's not okay.
Yeah.
Not in this day and age. And even if you're not completely woke. You know, like even if you're half woke.
Half woke.
Yeah.
No, I think you're right. And I think, just from my experiences too, that it's so hard to be the first person who steps out of line.
Oh, yeah.
And when that...
breaks bro code?
Yeah, exactly.
But if I had this... There are so many amazing men out there... And if I had this, like, because you hear about, like, toxic masculinity.
Yeah.
But we don't hear about, like, just masculinity.
Regular masculinity.
I'm okay with masculinity. Masculinity is okay. I'm okay to embody certain masculine traits. But if there was this idea that toxic masculinity defined my gender, I would want to do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And the thing of it is, too, that part of masculinity, the machismo factor, which is to be the iconoclast, to stand out from the crowd, to be a leader, but that rarely ends up in practice, right? No one wants to be the guy who stands out. No one wants to be the guy who speaks out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really hard, you know, it almost feels like toxic masculinity is a lack of machismo. It's a lack of wanting to be the leader amongst other men, of wanting to take that first step.
And I know there's been a couple times where I've heard guys do that.
Like,
step up and say something, and it wasn't me that had to say it. And just the acknowledgement that I gave that guy after, and he was like, wow, thanks for thanking me. Like, no one ever thanks me. And it was like, why don't we do that more often? Even if you're not going to be the guy that stands up, when some other guy does, how do you not have his back?
Or, so, you know what? You're absolutely right. We shouldn't.
So this is where the rubber hits the road for me, right? Like, it's like, so if you're not that guy, or anyone's not that guy who says, not okay, not cool, or when his friend says, oh, I did this, and he says, hey, that's not, that's assault. Like, are you out of your mind? Whatever, right? When you don't do that, then you become part of the silent majority that benefits from patriarchy.
Right.
And so then when people say, well, you can't paint every man with the same brush.
You kind of can.
You kind of can, because if you're staying silent on it, then you're benefiting from it.
And you know that too.
No, but, like, it's so that to me is the crux of the issues.
Right.
Like, it's like, we can't, you know, and this isn't about the men who are doing great work on violence against women, who are engaging and trying to do kind of stuff. But even the men I've talked to who do that work, they get ridiculed.
Oh, yeah.
They get picked on. They get called all sorts of names, right, from other men, instead of other people saying, no, I think we should all be good men. Because, Adam, this is your generation. You're not... you're not 70 years old where you grew up with, you know, certain attitudes that were so ingrained into your mind.
Right.
So it's like, if we can't break this in the younger generation, then what hope do we have?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it...
like, you know, to me, that's the issue. And so it's more than wearing a white ribbon on your jacket.
Right, and... When you see these things happening in the group, and I'm sure you've seen it too, body language says a lot, because there are always a couple of men who aren't laughing along.
No.
Mm-hmm. And who know this is going to a place that is not...
okay.
Not okay.
Mm-hmm.
And... But then won't take the next step, which is to vocalize, this is not okay.
Mm-hmm.
And in my social circles, it's always the guys who look at me and go...
Yeah, it's your responsibility.
They give me that raised eyebrow, like, oh, we know you got something to say about this.
This is your moment.
Yeah, this is your moment. And I want to say, no, this is your moment.
Right.
I'm always that person. This is your moment.
Yeah.
Right? And it's just like we see it with racism and classism.
Yeah, exactly.
And people will say it, and they know, like, they have that look, like, this isn't okay, or I'm saying something that I shouldn't say, or they'll acknowledge it with this, oh, this isn't politically correct, but...
Right. It's like, well... Locker room talk.
Yeah, why can't you be that person? Why are you looking for somebody else to hold everyone and acknowledge the, you know, the inappropriateness of what was said?
Maybe we'll make this the last sort of discussion area, but...
Really? We're having a good time.
I know, we are having a good time. we could go on for hours, I'm sure. But the other side of this that I don't think we've really talked about is the digital side of this, the social media side. Mm-hmm. And especially when it comes to having uncomfortable conversations. Mm-hmm. I mean, the internet's really no place for that. Mm-mm. But having said that, people will say things, make observations, and then... they get, you know, doxxed, they get, you know, attacked, you know, just by posing a question or saying, or, you know, saying something out loud that, you know, may be in a lot of people's heads. That seems to be, the internet, again, not the most appropriate place to have conversations, but that is where a lot of these conversations are happening. Mm-hmm. But they get shut down almost the moment they're posed. A lot of these really difficult conversations.
Well, I don't even feel like we have conversations on social media. No, they're statements, more, right? It's not even about, you know, what are your feelings on this, or I'm struggling with how this plays in to the discussion of violence against women. But it's statements, and it's, you know, Robin mentioned it in her book, and when we were doing that discussion, that it's not a discussion, right? And it becomes targeted, and it becomes filled with hate, and it's almost if we follow... and we like people who have similar views as us.
Yeah.
So then you see those ones that stand out that are different, who are either trolling or who are looking for, you know, to start conflict.
Yeah.
But it's, we never see people standing up in those situations, right? Where there's an actual dialogue. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, people will just end it with an F you, or you're nuts, or, you know, or we just delete it, because I know even myself, it gets to the point where you're just so sick of seeing the negative things that you're like, how can I can't respond to all these. Yeah. Or you really think like, is this person, no matter how much time I invest, are they going to think about things differently?
Yeah.
Or are they just here to have their voice heard?
Because there's no inflection on Twitter, you know, so you don't know if someone's trolling, you don't know if someone's being sincere.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard.
It's really hard.
Even with that Globe violence against women for the International Day, and the comments at the bottom just, you know, saying this is ridiculous, like this is women's problem, they need to deal with it, and just how you can think like that. Like, and to say in the comment before that, you know, you're the father of two daughters, or, you know, you have women in your life, or... even if you don't have women in your life, right? Yeah. Like, it's like, how do you think that it's... I understand that not everyone is an activist. I understand that not everyone, you know, needs to be on the ground. But just by living, everyone is a mentor.
Yeah.
And you have a choice of what kind of leadership you want to leave behind, or what kind of guidance you want to give to the next generation, whether it's family members, friends, work, social groups, and... being a part of that is about acknowledging that the way you talk, the way you engage, the way you discredit other people's work all reflects on you.
Yeah.
Right? And the kind of person that other people are looking to for some kind of guidance. Because the online is, it's terrible. It's terrible for people who are advocating and doing that work, because it is painful.
You become a target of vile hatred, you know, and that apparently that's okay.
Yeah. No. Yeah. And Robin mentioned that too, that, you know, she's struggling with having these conversations as a woman, and she'll like text her friends and say, you know, I'm having this thought. What do you guys think? Mm-hmm. Which is something you could never do on Twitter. You can't put these complex questions on Twitter, because God knows what you'll get.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, for sure.
And that's the thing, is that there aren't even a lot of safe spaces where, you know, I hear guys say that same statement all the time of like, why doesn't she leave? Why doesn't she leave?
Yeah.
And then they'll tell some horrific story of, you know, an unhealthy relationship they were in.
Mm.
And I was like, but why didn't you leave?
Right.
Well, I loved her. well, why is that an acceptable answer for you? But yeah. when we talk about women, you expect them to just leave, or, you know, if it was that bad, they wouldn't have stayed. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's just, we don't have those discussions, or we don't create those spaces for them, because everyone is, this is my opinion and that's what I'm putting forward, instead of trying to understand why the other side sees things a certain way, or what's going to be, how do we find our common ground? Because right. even in terms of, we're a feminist organization, but that means so much. Your idea of feminism yeah. Would be different, but looking at, you know, what can we come together on? And does it mean that we just want people to be safe? Okay. So that's going to, let's yeah. work on that. Like, yeah, let's start from there. Starting point. Right. Yeah. Instead of, do I want, you know, people can't get over men and women making the same amount of money, or the idea that men and women are the same, right? I'm not saying we have to agree on all of those things, mm-hmm. but that when we look at equality and we look at social justice, we can't deny that violence against women is about taking power and control from women because they are seen as less than.
Right. I have nothing to add. But, yeah, in a day-to-day way, and maybe this is where we can end it on, that I think people are always looking for, you know, what can I do every day? And we talked about, you know, saying something. When you hear or see something, say something. Don't be afraid of having a difficult conversation. And I think the third thing is, you know, we may not agree 100% on every issue 100% of the time, but we can always start with the stuff we do agree with. Mm-hmm. And I think everybody can agree that the events that happen every other day, where a woman is killed by her intimate partner, mm-hmm. from that to events like what happened on December 6, 1989, that is all wrong. Mm-hmm. And we should work every day to make sure it never happens again. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. 30 years yeah. and still counting.
Right.
30
years and
still yeah. counting. Still counting.
So yeah. that December 6th vigil this year will be at
Gilbert
McIntyre Funeral Home on Gordon. And since 1990, there's 750 women in Ontario that have died.
Yeah.
So, Ontario alone. We don't yeah. have the national statistics.
Because they're...
Well, we're keeping track of it.
Okay.
So we know those... And even those numbers are only based on what we got from police reports and things like that. So it doesn't include everybody.
Yeah.
Right? Those are just the ones that we could verify through the media.
Right.
Right? So I suspect that number is much, much larger. And that doesn't include women who, you know, slowly die because of, you know, childhood trauma, sex abuse that, you know, never recovered, mm-hmm. right? Like,
yeah.
And I think it's about 40 missing and murdered from Ontario from yeah. Indigenous women. And when we were looking at trans women, there isn't a database similar that collects that information, but there's one reported in Canada. But just like Sly was saying, the difficulty with how it's reported and the stigma mm-hmm. around it and the silencing, or even with the trans community family not wanting to acknowledge how yeah. a person identified, those stats are so difficult. And mm-hmm. like you mentioned, with changing how people report, media documentation for police will all impact whether we can track that idea of gender-based violence and the impact that it's continuing to have even 30 years later. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So 6 p.m. Friday, December 6th is the December 6th vigil this year. And I think for us, it's not only, it's a celebration of life in the sense that, like, these women are killed, they are taken from this world, but, you know, we need to continue to celebrate who they were and celebrate that we continue to fight and make progress so that this injustice, eventually we will stop counting. There will stop being this number, and hopefully, you know, women can die of old age and natural disasters instead of, you know, an epidemic like Sly said.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I remember when we were we were doing research for this book, and the December 6th massacre was the single issue that moved a lot of communities to build monuments for the 14 women who were killed, and then all the women who were killed since, right? And I remember I was in Montreal, and I was tasked with going to look for the monument there, because it took Montreal, I think, 10 years to build their monument to the murdered women. And it was, first of all, Montreal is super cold, and there's a ton of snow.
Yeah.
And so I had a hard time finding it. And then it was kind of buried under snow, but they have this walkway and these pillars with the letter of the name, you know, and it goes. And I remember, like, thinking about what it must have been like for that city to figure out how to honor these young women who were murdered. And then some of the families wanted gun control legislation, and other things that help to fight violence against women. And so, given that we're still having the same conversations, I think that we have and can do way more than we are doing, right? So it's important that the message around December 6th for me is, yes, we come together to honor, to reflect on the lives that were lost and the lives that were lost this year, and the impact that those lives have on the rest of their people. But also the issue is, we have to keep fighting. 30 years, right? And we're still not at equal pay.
Mm-hmm.
30 years, and we still, the stats have not gone down, Adam.
Yeah.
Right? So I think that when you look at that and you think, okay, there is a ton of work to still do, and we need people to engage in it. We need people to support the work of the Violence Against Women organization across this province. So when you ask what you could do, yeah, get involved. Donate money.
Mm-hmm.
Find ways of helping an organization. Mm-hmm. Volunteer your time.
Mm-hmm.
There's a ton of things you can do to sort of help further that cause. That's authentic, that's real, and that is something that is important to everybody. Not just because I know a woman who's important to me, but because this is important, period.
Mm-hmm. Right? To
the world that we want.
Yeah.
You know, globally, this is a global epidemic, right? Not just in Canada, around the world, the stats are staggering.
Yeah.
And yet, 30 years later, and here we are.
Half the world is women, so it should be important to all of us. Mm-hmm.
Should be. Yeah. But I urge people to get involved. Get involved. Do something. Take action. You know? And it can't just be us.
Yeah. Well, I hope people made it to the end of this and hear that message.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully we won't have to talk about this and... Well, hopefully we won't have to talk about it in terms of the severity even, like, this time next year. But, you know, maybe by the time, what would the 50th, 2049, 2020?
I likely won't be here, but...
Oh, you never know.
But that's the thing, right? It's like you'd think you'd retire out of your job. Like, you work yourself out of a job, but it's that's not going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. I know, when you think about how we started and what we set out to do was just protect women and kids. That's what we started off to do. That's it.
Yeah.
And here we are still. I mean, the anniversary is 30 years, but for Violence Against Women organizations, they've been at it 45 plus years.
Yeah.
You know, in a organized way. Fashion, they've been doing it forever, but in an organized fashion, you know, creating shelters, creating rape crisis centers, creating women's services, creating consciousness groups, creating opportunities for women to learn and support each other, right? Like, we've been at it a long time.
Mm. There's always hope, though.
Always hope.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, Sly and Jessica, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Adam.
And once again, that was Sly Castaldi and Jessica St. Peter of Guelph and Wellington Women in Crisis. If you would like to get involved as a donor or a volunteer, you can go to the Women in Crisis website at gwwomenincrisis.org, and the links there to donate or volunteer are readily available. There are two local commemorations for the National Day of Remembrance and Action on Violence Against Women. One of them is at the Thornborough Building at the U of G at 3:30 p.m. on Friday. And the other one, which is sponsored by Women in Crisis, is at Gilbert McIntyre and Son Funeral Home and Chapel at 1099 Gordon Street at 6 p.m. also on Friday. And that's it for this edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics and Sid Dale. Guelph Politicast is recorded at CFRU at the University Center on the U of G campus. To learn more about CFRU, just go to their website, cfru.ca. You can download the Guelph Politicast on Wednesday from Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. And you can download it from the host at Podbean at guelphpoliticast.podbean.com. When you subscribe to the Guelph Politicast channel, you will also get an episode of Open Sources on Mondays and an episode of End Credits on Fridays. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson or Guelph Politico. There's also the Guelph Politico Facebook page at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And if you'd like to help build a locally sourced independent media outlet in the city of Guelph, please consider donating to Guelph Politico, and you can find out how at guelphpolitico.ca/donate. And for all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.ca, where there will be a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you next week. And until then, see you next time.